You are listening to Tech Reads, interviews with emerging technology thought leaders. Our sponsor is Softech, the premier technology trade association that has been serving northern Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo County since 1997. Our mission is to create Softech moments where people connect, explore ideas, and create new business opportunities. Learn more at softec.org.
Welcome, everyone. This is Brian Schwartz with Softech's Tech Reads. This is a podcast where I interview authors, and we do it in a live studio audience, and this is the largest live studio audience we've ever had. We got about 10, 12 people here tonight, and I'm fortunate to be with John Couch. And John was instrumental in the early days of Apple. He's written several books. He will be featured in the next issue of Slow Life. But John, we had just done introductions around the room, so maybe just give us a little introduction about yourself.
Wow, where do you start, you know?
17 grandchildren, you can start there.
Yeah, no, actually I was born in Chicago. Fortunately, my parents had the good sense to move to California when I was 9 months old. And I've lived in California my whole life, except for 4.5 years where I went to high school in France.
Did you learn French?
At that time, yes. Okay, but it's
haven't
long
kept
gone.
It up. Okay.
I can order wine and I can eat. Okay. I went. My first 3 years were spent at UC Riverside as a physics major, and in my junior year, I walked into the final exam and there was one question on the final exam, and it was describe the motion of a spinning top in free space. Well, it had never been covered in the lecture, nor by any of the TAs, nor was it in the book. And I watched a lot of really smart people panic because they had not memorized the answer to that. And that was in the same year that I took a course called Horticultural Science 120, which turned out to be computer programming because it was the only department that could afford the IBM computer. And that's when I fell in love, because for the first time, I had to think. I had to create. It was a game, almost. And so I looked around the United States for a university and a computer science department, and UC Berkeley was starting one the very next year. And so I transferred to UC Berkeley, finished the undergraduate in one year, master's in 1 year, and then I spent another year on the PhD program.
But you knew from that moment that you wanted to be involved in computers?
I knew immediately in that class, yeah. Because it, I had this false sense of security that, you know, I had been in National Honor Society and people kept saying how smart you were, but I just had a good memory. Mm. And this was the first time that I was challenged to solve a problem whose answer wasn't in the back of the book under odd.
Did you successfully pass that test of the spinning top?
You know, probably not, but in those days, physics was graded on the curve, and, you know, a 30 was a C, and a 40 was an A, and, you know, it was hard to get an A, it was easy to get a C, so I think most people we just skidded on through, but I realized then that I wasn't going to be able to do that for the rest of my life, and I really needed to find what my passion was, and fortunately, it came in this crazy course called Horticulture Science 120.
That's a wild diversion, right?
Yeah.
Now, because you wanted to get in computers, you were drawn to go to HP right off the bat.
Yeah, I was at in grad school at Berkeley, and we had a placement office next to where our department was, and so we would interview HP, IBM, DEC, no Apple in those days, I ended up going to HP. To work on the HP 3000, which was a stack-oriented machine, which was unique, but we had studied it in school, and I felt it was a nice, easy transition to go from what I studied in school to HP. And so I wrote my first job was to write Fortran compiler, and that's when I realized that everything they taught me in school was theoretical, and Fortran was, you know, had real problems
practical
to do it. Yeah. And so that's when I wrote my first book called Compiler Construction theory and practice, because the theory came from the university, but the practice came from HP. I was there 5 years, and my boss, Dr. Whitney, who did the handheld calculator, the HP 35, which probably was one of the best lessons I've ever learned, because they went out and did market research, and if you guys are old enough to remember the HP 35, it adds, subtract, multiply, and divided in reverse Polish, and it was $395, and a market research company came back and said, don't build it because nobody wants it. And Bill Hewlett said, well, furthermore, he says, I want it, and furthermore, I want it to fit in the shirt pocket. 9 months later, it was doing $180 million in revenue, and the largest slide rule company in the world was out of business because they thought they were in the slide rule business, not in the computational business. So that was one of the first lessons that I really learned, is market research is only valid when you're operating in an existing environment, not where you're creating a new
market.
A new market.
Tom?
I was just curious, what year was that when you started your career?
72.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was 2 years old.
I've been around 78 years, so it's, but.
So it was at HP when you first crossed paths with Steve Jobs.
Tom Whitney was hired to be the engineering manager at Apple. And Steve was 20 years old at the time. I was 29, and he may become 21 in that year. And he set up a lunch for me to meet with Steve. And Steve was passionate. I mean, yeah,
he oozed it.
Yeah, he lived it. And what really sold me was, one, I felt that I could add some value to the company because they didn't really have a lot of software in those days.
Mm-hmm.
But Steve understood the difference between a vision on why you do something and a mission in terms of what you do. And he shared with me an article that he had read in the Scientific American where they had measured the efficiency of motion from point A to point B, different animals and man. And, you know, God's creation, man, was way down on the list, but somebody had the foresight to rerun the test, this time with man riding a bicycle,
okay,
which amplified their physical ability. Steve saw technology as an intellectual amplifier, something that would allow us to be more creative.
Bicycle of the mind.
Bicycle
of
mind. Everything flowed from the bicycle of the mind. Yeah. And so he hired me as director of new products. So my role with Steve was to define the new products of the future. And
how'd you hit it off with him the very first time when you guys?
A lot of it's in the book, but my first day at work was probably when I questioned my decision, because we were looking for peripherals for the Apple II. And the first team that came in had a printer, and it was a thermal printer. And I ushered him, you know, everybody wore suits and ties in those days, even coming into Silicon Valley. So I ushered him into a room not like this, and they put the printer on the middle of the table, and Steve was late. And Steve eventually came in, and he had Levi's, he was barefoot, and dirty feet, Levi's on, holes in the knees, t-shirt with holes in it. He sat in the middle of the table in a lotus position, picked up the printer and said, this is the piece of S. And I went, okay, did I make the right decision? How do I recover from this?
Wow.
And he left. And so I ushered him out. And the next meeting was with Dennis Hayes, who created the DC Hayes modem. It was a beautiful black plastic modem, gorgeous.
Wow.
Steve did the same thing. He came in, sat in the middle of the table, lotus position, picked it up, looked at Dennis and said, I'll take a million. And Dennis goes, excuse me, I can't make a million, you know? And that's when I saw the two sides of Steve.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, was he kind of a hippie?
Yeah, very definitely.
Okay.
He would consider that. I mean, he had been in a commune, mm-hmm, apple farm up in Oregon.
And what was him and Steve like together? Because were they kind of
opposite?
Were together?
Well, Woz was brilliant. IQ of over 200. Woz built his first computer in eighth grade.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Woz hand toggled into the Apple II the basic interpreter in hexadecimal. Okay, and that kind of Apple didn't have a lot of software in those days. I mean, they had the basic interpreter and they had two small utilities, something to move data from a cassette recorder into memory. And so 5 months later, they made me vice president of software, because that's really what I should have been hired to be in the first place. And the agreement was that I would find my replacement for Steve, and then I became the vice president of software. And I made the decision that the next computer after the 2 and the 3 needed to be a 16-bit computer, and made the decision to go away from Intel and to go with Motorola, because Motorola had memory management in its hardware and in its microcode, and I wanted to introduce high-level languages, procedure-oriented languages, because I knew that the market for the Apple II was limited by who could program in BASIC or 6502, and that's a pretty small market. And so we created a 16-bit computer, and that's when Steve and I saw the graphic user interface, which was exactly what I had imagined when I wrote datagramming, that someday we would have an environment where people can move their data from one application to another application. And so we set out to build the graphic user interface machine, and the first product was Lisa. And Mac, you couldn't program the Mac. You had to program on Lisa and then download it into the Mac. And
the Apple II Plus was never a graphical interface.
No.
It was what was the first Mac that came out?
Well, the 512.
Okay.
Or 128 Mac. Yeah, it can only handle 7 pages of a word processor. Mm-hmm. So it was quite limited. I had tried to convince Steve that the Lisa, which was really geared for the Fortune 500 in the office, and the Mac, which was really geared for personal in the home, that there should be some compatibility such that whatever you worked on in the office, you should be able to take it on the disk home and vice versa. But Steve saw compatibility as the antithesis of creativity. And so he botched that one.
Crazy. So you were there in sort of the beginning, how Apple went from zero to $1 billion in what, 5 years?
Yeah, 54th employee, zero to $1 billion in 5 years. The fastest growing company in American history at that time, which when you look back.
And was this in Palo Alto?
No, it was in Cupertino.
Cupertino, okay.
Yeah, on Vanley Drive, we had a little building.
And is that where they
built
their
big mothership? Then we had a second building, and a third building, and a fourth building, okay. And a fifth building. No, and then we moved over to where Four Face was, right off 280, because it had been destroyed in the earthquake. And that became the first Apple campus, Infinite Loop. Mm. And then we built the spaceship. But I couldn't handle the spaceship. Remember, I started in an office the size of this room right here.
Okay.
And to take 20 minutes to get to a meeting in the spaceship. And it was all glass, and people kept walking into the glass. And I'm 74 years old. It's time to move on. And Steve had obviously passed away. And people would walk off a long pier for Steve. The reason I wrote the book is because I thought he got a bum steer. People were writing about who he was, who never met him.
Right, because that sells.
Yeah, and Steve did some incredible things for people, flying people to hospitals in his jet, but he made people promise never to say anything. I just thought I need to tell a little different. I need to tell the more humane story of Steve. So there's a lot of stories in the book that have never really been talked about.
But those first 5 years, I want to get back to that for a second, but you were there at a very interesting time for that company. Like, what was it? Were you working 20-hour days? I mean, did you have any time for your family?
80 hours a week, and loving it was on the t-shirts. Yes. Yeah. No, in fact, that's one of the main reasons I decided to eventually leave, was we introduced the Lisa, the graphic user interface machine, at MIT in Boston, Boston Computer Society. Tremendous response. The next day, Steve and I were in the Carlisle Hotel in the penthouse, all the press coming in, doing the articles and interviews. And no one had ever seen anything like it before. And met with John Scully that night, trying to convince John to leave Pepsi-Cola to come and join Apple. And I think it was about 2 in the morning when I was still awake, and I looked over all of New York and the lights and said, wow, I thought I would be more euphoric than this. And that's kind of when I realized that I had been climbing this ladder, and maybe the ladder was, you know, on the wrong foundation, the wrong building. And I just had the sense I wanted to be home with my family. So I Well, I went on sabbatical.
Okay.
They sent me to Japan to do a little PR work in Japan, took the whole family. And then when I came back, I turned my resignation in, and the VP of Human Resources said, well, we won't accept it. And, you know, I'm not going to go into what I had to do to get out. But, you know, in the long run, I got out. And then...
And did you have four kids at this point?
I had three.
Okay.
With fourth on the way, which is another, you know, motivation to be at home and help. So we moved from Silicon Valley to San Diego, where we had had a beach house in Del Mar, to kind of get away from the attraction of doing this. I mean, I remember George Lucas was looking for a president for his Lucas Films, and my son goes, Dad, take the job, free Star Wars toys, you know? And I go, no, we need to extract ourselves from this community. We went down to San Diego and...
hard break.
Very hard break. And that's when I ended up spending 10 years rebuilding a Christian school. And I was able to learn a lot about...
education.
The kids, you know, and so...
Is that where this started?
That's where that started, and then...
We're talking about rewiring education.
10 years later, I went back to the Valley, and Steve said, you know, to me, he goes, Dad, you know, John, I failed education. And I don't know whether it's a marketing problem or a sales problem, but I will give you both. And if, you know, if you can't fix it, we're out of the business. And so we grew that from about a little bit less than a billion to 10 billion.
And how did you start that transformation?
You know, one advantage I had is Steve wasn't sure he wanted me to run education or to run software. And so he gave me 3 months incognito. So for 3 months, I was in Apple with nobody knowing. They knew who I was and that I was, you know, on
Steve's
side.
Did you retain that 54th position?
Yes, you retained the number, okay. Yeah. Yeah, and so I had 3 months to look at Apple, look at the culture, what had changed from the time that I had been there, realized that Apple was investing in OS X, he was banking the company on OS X, and then only 6% of the machines in education could run OS X. So I knew I had a challenge there. They were investing very heavy in retail, so I knew I needed to somehow leverage the retail stores for education, and they were moving into iTunes. And I saw the opportunity with iTunes, the music industry paying for this incredible platform all over the world. How could I hijack it? How could I make educational content on iTunes? And so I put my first plan together. And then the other thing I realized is because in 78, when Steve tried to recruit me, he asked me to take a very substantial pay cut. No one in Apple in those early days made more than $40,000. And that was Steve's wisdom, because he wanted people to come who shared the vision, not who saw it as an academic opportunity. And so I told Steve after that meeting, I need to think about it, because I'm making close to $80,000 and you're offering me $40,000. And I'm going, taking over a group of 140, and you're asking me to work for a 21-year-old kid with
plus
no people.
You voluntarily left that world, right?
Yeah.
You're considering going back.
And so he knocked on the door one Friday night with an Apple II and put it on the kitchen table and told my 6-year-old son, Christopher, you can have this if your dad comes to work for me.
Smart guy.
Wow.
So in which I gave every engineer who came to work for me an Apple II. But what I saw in Chris was the first digital native. You know, I mean, I didn't think what he get on that computer could be done by a 6-year-old. And so
especially a terminal line.
That was computer. that was the kind of the key. Well, I'll give you a crazy story. I'm at MIT meeting Seymour Papert, who developed Logo, right? So I get a copy of Logo, I bring it back to Chris, and I said, look, Chris, it can draw a box, coordinate. And he looks at me like I'm an alien, and he goes, well, Dad, why can't I just draw it? And I, bingo, yeah, and that was became the first drawing package, you know? Mm. 6-year-old kid telling us, why can't I just draw it? But anyway, so my main theme when I got back was this is a digital generation, that the students in your classroom, your customers in the classroom, are thinking different. They're thinking visually because that's how they absorb most content, and we're missing it. Okay, mm-hmm. And we need to get away from the memorization world and move into what I call challenge-based learning. Those of you from Cal Poly will know it as learn by doing. But challenge-based learning had 4 components to it. One, it needed to be relevant. Because people learn from intrinsic motivation, not extrinsic motivation. And our schools are based on extrinsic motivation, you know? That's the way it was with me, you know? You don't get this A, you don't get this, or you get this. Secondly, the environment needs to be creative, mm-hmm. And we needed to flip it. Normally, when I ran the school, the creative people were the teachers, and then they created this incredible pedagogy, and then they told 40 kids to do the same thing. It needed to be the other way around. We needed to be able to challenge the kids to show their creativity. That's why it's called challenge-based learning, and not project-based learning, because the kids have to pick the project in order to make it relevant. And it also requires technology. And then the third component was collaboration. They need to work as a team because they leverage off each different skills. Back to Jobs and Woz. Woz was brilliant. Woz, IQ of 200. Woz could program. Steve didn't know how to program. Steve knew how to sell. Okay, you put those two together and you've got Apple. Same thing in a collaborative. I realized at that time that every project I did in school was a single project. I never had the advantage of working with Eddie Thacker, who was brilliant, right, on a project. And then finally, it needs to be challenging. Kids, all you gotta do is look at the games. Kids wanna get to the next level, to the next level, to the next level. They wanna be challenged. It's like a Sudoku, you know? Do you give them four quadrant Sudoku or a 16 quadrant Sudoku? So those elements, relevant, creative, collaborative. Yeah, when I went to school, collaboration was called cheating, right? And then challenging. And so that's what this book is all about. And I did write a follow-on book called System Failure. Mm. But the system that I was referring to was not the institution of education, but the pedagogy that's continually to be forced, fed. But when COVID hit, all of a sudden, system failure got a whole new definition. Mm. And so I put it aside, and the last chapter of that book was about AI. And I said, well, why don't we write a book on AI? So we picked 30 industries, and we showed examples of where AI is being used to change those industries, and then to turn it around and challenge their educational community. How are you going to better prepare for this world?
Yeah.
And that work trying to come out. And I want to talk to you later because I have a company in China called Squirrel AI, who has 2 million Chinese students on AI, and they're coming into the U.S. And they've got 20 years of data on 2 million students. Change is coming. The question is, are we going to stick our head in the sand and ignore it, or are we going to think outside the box a little bit and say, the focus needs to be on the student.
Right.
And that's why I always talk about technology not as the, what was the old IT? image that they used to do, the total cost of
ownership.
Total cost of ownership. And education should be the total cost of opportunity. Mm-hmm. And so the focus needs to be on the students, and it's not. The technology was used at the administrative level, you know, and not necessarily to empower the students. By the way, this is the only room I've ever been into that doesn't have apples.
Might have to do something about that, Karen.
They're in the back.
So unveil the curtain right now.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, though, the leap to come to San Luis Obispo, what, 3 years ago, 4 years ago? How did you
4 years ago. Well, my son married a Cal Poly girl.
Okay.
And my son went to Penn, computer science major at Penn. And by the way, his daughter, my granddaughter, was one of the three women to graduate in computer science from Baylor. So we now have three generations of computer science. He was working, he did work with General Magic as a student, and decided that they would wanted to raise their family here and not in South San Francisco. So he has a company called, he's an app developer, but he also a designer. He's got butter companies and different things. He does all the labels and the graphics for the winery. My younger son does all the advertising and the.
So you saw it as an opportunity to be closer to your family, well, and Chris, start something new.
For Chris, yeah.
Okay.
And then his younger brother said, "I want." He was in Chico. He's an architect. He says, "I want to come to SLO where my brother is." So we helped him get started by buying some homes in Pismo Beach area and remodeling them. And then the younger son, who was decided to come, and he's videographer and advertising and that type of thing. And my daughter was the last holdout. She was in Texas. And she goes, "I don't want to come to California, you know." But we helped her. We helped her, but her kids convinced her, right? Okay. Because the cousins said, "We want to be with the cousins." And the cousins are, I mean, I can't even tell the difference sometimes between the girls as to which family, because they look so much alike. So now we have all 17 here. Tyler is the oldest, and the youngest is 5.
And you stretch from SLO to Santa Barbara and
yeah,
Arroyo
mostly
Grande.
Arroyo Grande and
okay.
SLO.
Yeah.
And both my middle son and, well, Chris had 2 children. The one that graduated from Baylor, and Johnny's graduating from Cal Poly on June 14th. And the other 2 families all homeschool.
Okay, so this was the place to be. And you're in the process of building your last house?
I just got blessed. So I came down, Rob Rossi, you know, who's the other 78-year-old bachelor in town, and we have dinner most of the time when he's not somewhere else. And I said, "Show me around." And so he, 3 days, I brought my
this
brother.
This is his building.
Oh,
yeah,
okay. This
yeah,
is
there's 200 of them around here somewhere. Yeah.
But
so I said, "Show me around." And so I brought my brother, and I brought my friend who was a Michelin chef, because I really wanted to start a Michelin restaurant here, because I think we need it. And we went all over. Last thing on Sunday afternoon, he says to me, "Let me show you the best property in all of SLO." I'm like, "Okay." And he takes me up to the 48 acres between Serrano and Lincoln on the east side of Mount Madonna. He says, "I've been trying to buy it for 15 years. But what happened was that Francis Brezzi, whose father was a Serrano and his mother was a Hillbrand, two of the wealthier Mexican families that had been here earlier. She had left the property. There's 6 parcels. She had left parcel 1 to the Monsignor. And she'd left the other 5 parcels to the mission, to the church, with the stipulation they could not sell it as long as the Monsignor was alive. Well, the Monsignor passed away. When Bresley passed away, she left it to the mission. When the Monsignor passed away, he left it to the mission. So the mission had these 6 parcels. And so when I asked Rob, I said, "Rob, this is perfect for my homestead, right? I can put my whole family here." I said, what's the status? And he says, you know, I really don't know. I'll call on Monday. He called on Monday, and they said, well, the lawyer says, well, it's going on the market on Thursday. Mm. So I said, make him an offer.
Wow.
And so I made him an all-cash offer, no restrictions. And, you know, I think at first they said, well, maybe we ought to test the waters on Thursdays. But the attorney said, look, you know, the only people that are going to buy this are developers. And you're not going to get your money. Well, it took me 3.5 years to get a permit for a house. So that attorney gave them valid advice.
Wow, that's pretty quick.
Yeah, so anyway, we're building now kind of an Italian piazza. Yeah. Mm. And, you know, someday I'll find out why I'm so blessed. But in the meantime, I'm content to take it a day at a time.
So, and then I'll open up for questions, but here's what I threw out at John, because a lot of what motivated this book was that when they first brought computers to students, they noticed the students were just using them like large calculators, that they were hardly scratching the surface of what the capability of these computers were. And I said, John, what if, like, what is capable of tapping into the knowledge of a computer? There's only one entity that has the intelligence to leverage a computer for all of what a computer can do, and it's called AI. What if computers were actually not invented for us, but were invented for AI? Like, it's kind of a weird concept when we developed this tool that we literally don't even have the mental capacity to fully exploit or leverage the way AI, the computer, can itself. And I just wanted to throw that out at you.
I can only answer that based on my experience, and I'm definitely not an AI expert. But I took my first AI class in 1970.
Okay.
And it was all about list processing, which basically means you're dealing with large, complex pieces of data, primarily stored in trees, so you can traverse down, ask questions, go down, come back up, play chess. Perfect example. The only thing AI in that class, as far as I was concerned, was Professor Deutsch, because he could write on the board with both hands, which made it very difficult to take notes. Okay? But when I look at AI, let me start step one, and then maybe try to expand it a little bit. There's an example in my book of a fifth grade class in Chicago, Illinois. It's a physical class, Chicago, Illinois. One student is reading at the first grade level. One student is reading at the eighth grade level. There are 6 different reading levels in that classroom. The time that it would take a teacher to find the appropriate material that's within the grasp, I'm not going to go into all the theory and stuff like that, is more than 40 hours a week. All right? Now, Steve used to ask me to do these miraculous things, right? I want every application in the world running on the Apple II by Christmas. And I'd say, Steve, I believe in miracles, but only God can schedule them. And last time I looked, you're not God, okay? We ask our teachers to schedule a miracle every week in the class. Mm. I see AI as an agent for the teacher that, given the data, that large amounts of data from those students, could bring back the next assignment for each one of those students.
Custom tailored
to where they are. Mm-hmm. To me, that's a positive use of AI, okay? But when you really think about AI, it's doing something that we can't do. I mean,
well, it's even speaking in languages. Did you know that when you have two AIs talking to each other, they speak in languages that we don't even understand?
Well, the digital coding, yeah. But how many things can we keep on our memory at a time? 7?
Yeah, 6 or 7.
Okay. Think of AI basically having, one, access to unlimited amounts of data. All right? And being able to process that data. That's why, you know, the graphic chips and the big power requirements and everything that we're talking about. So they can process information very, very, very quickly and bring back certain informations. You know, it's, I should have brought my I just did an interview with for the Apple's 50th anniversary with Dave, and he thanked me by sending me back an AI song.
Dave Congleton?
No, not this. He was on Sunday morning on on Today Show, and so is it creative? Yes, but is it pulling anything out? Is it using anything that doesn't exist? No. Okay, and so you know, I think there's still a human component. They did a study of the last 100 Nobel Prize winners. You know what the common theme for those Nobel Prize winners was? They were all experts in multiple disciplines, chemistry and physics, biology and chemistry, etc. And so that's where the discoveries really come from. And it's the opposite of the way we teach. Here's math, you know, here's science.
Pick one.
They never come together.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's why one of the things that was most exciting about being a vice president of education for Apple was watching these schools, one school in the desert. The challenge was, is our water safe to drink? Well, the teacher didn't know the answer. Principal didn't know the answer. The county supervisors didn't even know the answers. Those kids basically tested the water and found that there was an arsenic level in the water. And then they started asking questions. Well, who determines what level of arsenic is safe? So it's not a, okay, I'm going to do these 12 math problems and I'm done. Now I'm going to go play basketball. It's this snowballing
curiosity.
Yeah. And that's what we've killed. We've killed the curiosity. And what we do with curious kids is we say, you know, sit down, shut up. You know, don't draw outside the lines. Well, that's where all the success comes from, drawing outside the lines, drawing outside of physics, drawing outside of chemistry, drawing outside of biology. So we've got it backwards. And the sad thing for me is I think politics has gotten into the game. It should never be. And we haven't changed. I mean, it was created for the Industrial Revolution where we wanted everybody to do the same thing because to be more creative costs more money in the industry factory. And we've got to change it. Mike Market, who was my first boss at Apple, used to refer to a problem as a 20,000 pound marshmallow. How do you move a 20,000 pound marshmallow? No matter how many, just a whole bunch of people taking bites at a time, right? We've got a 20,000 pound marshmallow problem. And it's the kids that are losing out. You know, so I worked with a company in Michelin, Mexico. What was this? Michicon. The company is called, they have a school called Varmon, and they actually created a software company to go with the school. And they created a challenge-based learning curriculum from age 3 through 9th grade. Everybody focuses on the same challenge. So I went and I visited, and the 8th graders had built a solar-powered go-kart that had failed because they picked material that was too heavy for the energy to move it. The 6th graders had built solar-powered backpacks to charge their iPads and their iPhones. And the first graders had built a solar-powered oven. Okay. The company Varmon has, I think, 121 schools. One school is in the mountains, didn't even have electricity. We had to bring electricity in, give them the iPads. The average, the PSA scores for those 21 schools finished 6th in the world. And yet Mexico is down at 90 something, whatever. So I think the kids have a hell of a lot more potential than we give them credit. just ask any grandparent, you know, who deals with the kids and in a natural environment and says, man, you know, they're building Lincoln Logs. They're doing, you know,
well, and with AI, they have this tool at their fingertips that we never had growing up. I mean, the fact that it will code for you and build apps, and if you're a young person, you have time to, first of all, play with these tools more than those of us who are out in the working world, because, you know, finding time to work with these tools, but the things that they can create with friction.
But that's the key. That's what Steve was saying right from the beginning, back in 78. You know, technology is an amplifier. Mm. You can use it to write, you know, you can use it like we do in professional world, write, or you can use it to solve problems. And the fact that I don't have to go to 4 years of college to learn how to program anymore, that's just gave me an amplified tool. I bought all my grandkids two things. The guy that the kindergarten was created by, you'll help me remember.
Friedrich Froebel.
He was a son of a mission.
Lutheran pastor.
And he thought kindergarten should be about creativity. Mm-hmm. Because God is creative, the kids are creative. So there was no memorization, there was no literacy, there was field events out into nature, and then he created the Froebel tools, which with strings and blocks and stuff. I brought you one a long time ago. And then the kids would come back in the classroom and replicate something they'd seen in nature. Well, when we brought kindergarten over to the US, you know what we did with it? We pushed first grade down into it. Mm-hmm. And we made it about literacy. Mm-hmm. Even though we know that kids are gonna learn to read at different ages. And what do we tell the kid that's not reading, you know, in fourth grade? And we still have them, right? Mm. No, we push them forward, but we tell them you're stupid. Move, go on. All right, so.
Get out of the way.
Now, MIT's Graduate School of Architecture is still using the Froebel tools. So I also bought, there's a thing called Crunch Labs, and he's an ex-NASA Apple employee that builds these kits. And you subscribe to these kits. They're programming kits, they're, you know, domino knock, it's all kinds of
creative stuff.
Yes, engineers. Mm. Learn to be an engineer.
Okay.
And so those are the kinds of things that should be in the schools, the maker labs, things of that nature. I remember I was in one school and the assignment was to measure the volume of, you know, typical square or cylinder or whatever. The kids decided they wanted to measure the volume of their first letter of their name, which is not, you know, it's not going to be in any book, all right? And so what they did is they went into the maker lab and they made a vessel of the first letter of their name, and they measured the volume, which means they had to know how the volume of a square, they had to know the volume of the different
there's an intrinsic motivation.
Yeah, they'll work all night on that. I watched my son Christopher, who had a computer at 6 years old. I mean, he just, you know, he was on that thing forever, solving problems that I didn't think a kid could solve. Mm. You know, he went to the state history fair. He just did incredible things. He ended up going to the University of Pennsylvania to their engineering school.
Okay, questions, please. Anything we haven't touched on yet and that would enlighten Tyler to something he doesn't know about his grandfather.
Yeah, you can go either book, Rewiring or the Apple.
I mean, one of the things I think we, in the writing critique was like, was there a story with Steve that nobody's ever heard that would really kind of shed some light on the character?
I think there's a couple, and maybe in the book.
Okay.
I think the first one was, I lived within walking distance from Steve in Los Gatos when I first started. And Steve was a perfectionist. I mean, he had an English Tudor house that was impeccable, but all he had was a mattress on the floor, a Tiffany lamp, a Maxwell Parrish painting, and a three-door dresser. And as I walked up to the house,
true minimalist.
Yeah, when I walked up, that's what his head was his head was in art and beauty, but it was all Apple, right? And so I walked up to the front door, and I saw a piece of paper on the lawn. And I picked it up, and it was an Apple stock certificate for 400,000 shares. And I knocked on the door, and I go, "Steve, I think this belongs to you." And he goes, "Oh, yeah, must have blown out the window." And he opened the drawer, and he threw it in. So I knew from that moment on that it was never about money for Steve. Mm. You know, it was always, he told me, he said, he goes, "John," when he was hiring me, tried to hire me, he goes, "Everything that I own, the car that I drive, the clothes that I wear, the food that I eat, okay, is someone else's accomplishment. I want to give something back." Hmm. And he, you know, he was adopted, and that bothered him a little bit. In fact, he had been adopted twice, because the first people that took him decided they wanted a girl. And I think it bothered him that he was given up, you know, because he was the result of two graduate students at Berkeley. I think that bothered him a lot. And ironically, his favorite restaurant was owned by his dad, and his dad never knew Steve Jobs was his son.
That's an interesting parallel, right?
But I think the my favorite one, because it really showed the human side of Steve, is when Steve and I used to go to Stanford for what we called brown bag lunches. So we would invite all the students to come in, you know, in the physics labs, and we would sit on stools, and they would bring their lunches in, and they'd ask us questions, right? And I remember the first questions he got was, "What kind of people is Apple looking for?" Well, my mind's immediately going to my experience, which was Hewlett Packard, which was an engineering degree and an MBA. That was, you know.
That's how you could get them.
Yeah, and before I could even say anything, Steve said, "Well, think of an ice cream sundae." And I go, "Where is he going?" You know? And he goes, "It's not the two scoops of vanilla ice cream." He goes, "It's not the whipped cream." He goes, "It's not even the cherry." He says, "We're looking for the few nuts on top." Boom, resumes came in like crazy, right? You know? But he spoke in pictures. And I learned a lot from that too, because I'm a kind of a visual person myself. And I think one of the first reviews I ever got was the fact that I could take very complex subjects and break it down and communicate to people in a much peaceful, piece by piece language. But that was Steve. So what got me to lead to that was, we were on a plane in Italy, and we were sitting getting ready to take off, and there was an announcement that there's a bomb threat on the plane. So if you would please sit quietly while we remove the luggage. And Steve and I are going, we're definitely in Italy, because why aren't they moving us and not the luggage, right? So I think it kind of upset him a little bit. And so after we had taken off, he says to me, he goes, "You know, John," he goes, "I really admire you." He goes, you work as hard as I do, and yet you're married." And he goes, "I really want to be married. Where can I find a good wife?" And I go, "Well, Steve, I found mine in college, but you didn't go to college." I said, "You might be able to find one at church, but you don't go to church." And we went down two or three of these things, and finally we said, "It's impossible, Steve." Because Steve never really knew whether somebody really cared about him or about what he could give them. And it's tough. It was really, really difficult for him.
Did he stay in touch with you after he was first pushed out of Apple, like, or when you were on your
break? He went to Next, and a number of the people that I had brought to Apple went with him to Next, and he'd call me every once in a while and ask me for advice, because you know when I came to Apple, I raised the average age 2 years, okay, but I had been managing a lot of people at Hewlett Packard, so I was I think that was the other thing that Steve did really well, is he hired people that the company would grow to and not over. So, I mean, I went from managing 140 people to managing nobody. Mm-hmm. You know, very few people, I think, would see that as a career opportunity, right? So he hired people that when the company grew to a certain level, the management team was there for that. Because in the early Apple days, I used to teach the Apple University course for new managers. Mm. And everybody would come to Apple with their business plan, their solution to for Apple to be successful in this, you know, carving its way across this minefield of technology. And so Ann Bowers was the VP of Human Resources, and she was married to Bob Noyce. And the Noyce Foundation just gave Cal Poly 8 figures for a new engineering school. And so Ann would dress up as an employee. And so all the new managers would come in, and they'd sit in there, and Ann would come in with a three-piece suit on and a tie and a bunch of books, you know, like you are what you eat and all this kind of stuff. And I said, there's a seat right up here in front. And she'd come up front, and she'd drop the books, and I'd pick up these books, and I'd go, you know, where Apple's going, no one's ever been, so you won't really need these books. And I opened the window and threw them out. You should have seen the managers scramble, because they all had brought a business plan from IBM, you know, everything that they were going to do to make Apple successful. And what we were trying to say is, you know, we have to create a market. You know, all your market research isn't gonna help you. I mean, you know, Henry Ford said it first, right? Said if I'd asked people what they wanted, they would have said a faster horse. And that, and the HP 35 follows that same thinking. And Ralph Waldo Emerson said, people can only perceive what they see.
They don't know what they want until they see it. Yes, Tom.
So I was curious, when did you actually leave Apple?
I left Apple 3 years ago.
Okay, because I kind of look back at my lifetime so far, and I think back like when the internet, that was like a huge change in life. And then I look at this. I mean, this is just amazing. And I remember hearing Steve Jobs talk about that. I got interviewed by a Cal Poly girl when I was already graduating from MBA school at Cal Poly. And she's like, what do you think about this iPhone thing? You're like, would you ever use this? I'm like, no, it's just so weird thinking about it, but you can do so much in the power. And then now it's like AI.
Well, and I held out on a flip phone longer than most. It wasn't until a client looked at what I was using. He's like, I'm not going to hire you because you're not using this technology that everyone's using. But, and then I have kind of a love-hate relationship with the phone. It's like, I like to disconnect and not be so accessible. And it's sort of, they say even if a phone is in the room, that your mind is sort of occupied by what's maybe there waiting for you, so you don't give your full attention to...
Who's in charge? You or the phone?
And Steve Jobs said this thing's going to be connected to your hip. It's like part of your body. It's like...
Yeah.
Well, I mean, my grandkids don't get a phone until they have a job. And hasn't ruined them.
Yeah. That's interesting.
Please try.
That's a question, and it has to do with boredom. When I took my son out of middle school, he's getting ready to go into middle school, and he went to a makerspace. Mm-hmm. I homeschooled him, because I used to be a teacher, and then he went to a makerspace program, and the teacher at the time at the makerspace said, if he's been in school for 8 years, it might take him 8 months of boredom to the point where his mind starts working again. And that was almost exactly what happened. Hmm. And so he said, just bear with us as you watch your kid doing nothing except reading. And I'm like, well, I can deal with the reading. The reading's great. He can read all he wants. And then he started finally creating, and he started writing movies. But it took getting him out in nature to say, just tell me 3 words of what you see out here. And so with clients now, I'm finding, like, I have neuroscientists who are like, spinning around, the life is falling apart, and I have to drop them in to just slow down, stop everything. And one said, I said, if we really slow down, what do you hear? And she's like, I'm hearing I need to go out under my willow tree. But that's ridiculous. And I was like, stop. I said, you just heard your own wisdom tell you what to do. So I have this, you know, I love AI. Brian's taught me quite a bit already, but I really have to use, I have to have a certain level of wisdom so I don't let the AI be my discernment, tell
that's
me
what
to do.
That's why I meant who's in charge.
Mm-hmm. That's what?
Mm-hmm. That's why I said who's in charge.
Yeah.
So for me, I felt I had concrete on my brain from school.
And it took
Apple to knock it off.
Wow. Yeah.
And I also felt that if I had stayed at HP 2 or 3 more years, I would have never been creative. Because that's, you know.
Not the environment.
When you're creative, you're a troublemaker.
Yes.
You know, I mean, the beauty of Steve is I remember, when we made the presentation to the board on moving to the graphical user interface, which both Steve and I wanted to do, had other people who did not want. They got fired, okay? And the board says, well, what will happen to our Apple II business? And Steve and I looked at each other and said, it'll be destroyed, but better by us than someone else. We never feared IBM or the big corporations.
Yeah.
We feared the kid down the street. Had nothing to lose, like Steve. Sold his van, Waz sold his HP calculator, and the rest is history. And I remember, you know, 1 month before Christmas, Steve obsoleted the best-selling iPod in the history of Apple for a new one. Right? Who does that? You know, the bean counters. When the bean counters take over, it's done. You're over. And Steve had to, you know, the dynamics. And I mean, I remember one day he looked at a lawyer and said, you can't do that. He goes, I want a can-do law department. And if I can't get a can-do law department from you, I will get a can-do law department. End of thing, right? Done. And the bean counters didn't, Steve ran it.
Yeah. Well, you know, it makes me think about how we're held back by
reminds me of Elon Musk, actually. The two are very similar. I'm reading his book now, and I'm going, this is an incarnation of Steve.
Who is it?
Elon Musk.
Elon. Mm. Wow. Yeah. Okay, any other questions?
So
yes, Susan.
How long ago did you write the book about education, and what are you doing today with all of your free time?
Oh, I don't have any free time. I have two companies. I wrote it. This was the best-selling educational book in China in 2019. Okay, and I went over on a tour. We did a podcast there with one of the educators. 750,000 people are on the line. I mean, that's here we are. Here's in China. So we have a company in China that I'm helping called Squirrel AI. We have the company with the former opera singer, Crescendo Studios for younger kids, because we know that music improves language development and math skills.
You got this writing thing on the side.
We're finishing the AI book, and I'm writing a new book now, like I said, An Ordinary Man. And I got 17 grandkids, and so there's a birthday every couple weeks. And I do have a winery. But the winery, and I'm building a dream, but it's all in my kids' names. So I want them to, you know, I want the, it's an Italian piazza. We did two movies, Sound of Freedom, and I just finished one called The Italians. It's comedy, it's on Amazon.
And Death of Recess, too.
I was just going to say that. We got a new one called Death of Recess. But now, here's what happened there. I'm a little worried about that one, because when I couldn't do System Failure, and I met the guys at Cal Poly's Entrepreneurial Center, and they needed some help. He had been working on the documentary for 10 years, but he didn't really have any of the educational research experts and stuff, so I got him to interview all those guys. But he went undercover at the National Education Association. And all of a sudden, my nice documentary, which was an expansion of the pedagogy, has become a little bit more dangerous because he found Satan worship there and a bunch of other stuff.
Whoops.
And I said, you know, you're going to force me to get a bodyguard now.
Wow. Wow.
And he's sending me the final cut of that before it goes to the distributors.
So this is like a new version, because wasn't that movie screened a couple years ago?
Yeah, it was a new version. Mm. But it visits the school in Mexico. It visits schools all over the world. Mm. It points out this unhealthy symbiotic relationship between the SATs and the top universities. And it exposes a lot of things that I think people now better understand, but it probably, we'll see what happens. The original thing was recess is needed. You know, I mean, it's critical. Arts are critical. Everything that's critical for the development of our children is being pushed aside. And
it's not fair to them.
Yeah, so I have that yet to get out. I do a lot with students, especially the entrepreneurial. I started something, so I donated the chemical analysis machine to Cal Poly because I wanted them to, you know, be at the level of UC Davis when it comes to winemaking. And then I challenged them, and I worked with the students, and we came up with an institute called Beyond the Glass. And it basically says, let's leverage out Cal Poly's agricultural understandings, water, et cetera, and create this incredible wine. But the institute basically allows local winemakers to leverage the research and the chemical analysis machine. And so we did that. We did that with Jay Lohr. So
you want to raise the bar for wine?
I want Cal Poly to be the Paso is going to be the primary wine region. So I have a lot of things on the plate. I also personally start every morning first 2 hours in the morning or. I read daily devotionals, and I also did 4 praise and worship CDs during COVID. And so every morning since July of 2017, I've spent the first hour to 2 hours reading 6 different devotions, journaling, and then extracting wisdom from my journal and posting on Facebook. I have almost 3,000 posts. You
what? What time do you get up in the morning?
6.
Okay, just making sure it wasn't 4.
Okay. No, that was I leave that for the CEO of Apple.
Well, I didn't realize you had just retired 3 years ago. That was news to me.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You're just sort of in this.
I probably wouldn't have retired, but what happened was the Monday before the book was supposed to come out on Wednesday. One of the fellows said, you know, we don't think an Apple vice president should be writing a book. And I said, well, it's all been approved. Yeah. He goes, our lawyers don't think that Apple should be writing a book. But it had already been done. Mm. And he said, well, why don't you go on as a consultant? And, you know, I was 70-something years old, and I said, okay, you know, I can do that, you know. I can create my own pension plan and everything. And then 1 year later, Tim Cook's book comes out. So to be honest with you, my gut instinct was, because Steve hired me, and I was a known commodity to Steve, I had a nice salary. And I think the guy that I was working for was a sales guy, and he was looking for places to cut. And he felt the best way to cut was to have me move out of the main line and onto the sides. Because at that time, Tim had asked me to speak at every state. So I basically, this was a lecture before I wrote the book. And it was, and you know, what was interesting about it, my favorite states, they were the either the board or the superintendent conferences, were the South. Because the people in Alabama knew that they were the last opportunity that those students had if they weren't successful in school. My worst states, California in New York. Mm-hmm. I sat down with 17 people in California, all top educators, run the show, and all I heard all day was, can't do that, we can't do that, we can't do that. And I don't get frustrated too often, but I got frustrated that day, and I said, you realize, of course, that every problem we have in this state did not come from a student. It came from an adult. And I left the room.
All right, one more question. We're way over what I had planned. Anything, Heidi?
I mean, I have a lot, but they're not quick, so. I'm in education. I'm a VP. I do business development and relationship development with W.W. Norton Publishing House. And we're based in New York, and I was just there last week, and I was in Las Vegas last week at a career education college conference. So career education colleges are hoping to close the gap between four-year universities and what they're not producing, which is plumbers and welders and, you know, things, jobs that, and if you watch the job market,
well, absolutely right.
The people that are working those jobs, it's in 3 years, it's going to be flipped.
Yeah.
And we think we don't have enough of those now. And so everything you're saying,
I have one of my grandsons wants to be a plumber.
Yeah. Yay.
You know, and so.
Put on the books now. It's a really big problem, and of course I've got a couple of kids of my own that I'm raising, and one just graduated from college, and so there's just all of this stuff that it gets overwhelming, and it gets you've got to figure out where to start.
Well, and I think the other thing we have to understand, and that's why we wrote the AI book, is that AI is actually changing those industries as well. I mean, I was at the Formula One, and I met a company that is doing a Formula One engine design with AI, reducing the space, and then printing those engines with a 3D printer. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's a building in China, I don't know how many stores, that has been printed with a 3D printer. So that's why I wrote the AI book, was simply to say, look what's happening today. Mm-hmm. And we're still asking kids to memorize.
It makes no sense.
Right. When I asked one of my grandsons, who was in eighth grade, I said, what's your favorite homeschool? What's your favorite course? And he goes, geology. And I didn't even know geology existed until it was an elective in my sophomore year in college, right? So it gets back to the Nobel Prize. They are cutting across the multiple disciplines, because that's where the, you know, the creativity and the new products come from.
Fred, did you have a question?
Well, I was just going to ask what could be done today for the future. You know, when calculators came out, lots of resistance in education.
Yeah, the pencil came out, there was a resistance. I'm serious.
They need to know how to do long division. Yeah. They need to, you know, you got to do long division. When word processors became available, kids are never going to be able to spell.
Yeah.
You know, they can't use spell check. You can write your paper, but you can't. Well, with AI, where are we with that in terms of the future? And are teachers going to embrace it? Are they going to resist it? What's going to happen?
I think you've got to sit back and look at a whole new education model. You've got to look at the technology that's available. We got to get back to what's the purpose of education? It's the student. What's best for the student? And, you know, using AI to write an essay is not best for the student. Mm-hmm. Forget essays. You know, I mean, we may have to go to, you know, all verbal tests. Let's just test the individual. Do you know the information? An A may be you've created something new. A C means you know the information. I don't know. But it's going to be difficult, because the education as an institution is the 20,000 pound marshmallow. You know, I mean, I met the Secretary of Education for the last 30 years, and even the one under Trump was all charter school. It was all charter school. And I go, well, if they're not teaching any different in the charter school, what difference does it make? You know, it's a bigger core issue. It may be competition from foreign countries that kicks us in the butt, just like the space program did, and says we got to do something different, and we got to do it fast. I don't know, but I it's why we homeschool. You know,
we have a huge, there's a huge acceptance of it right now in the university. But the problem is they don't know what how to accept it appropriately. So they're initiating acceptance in the form of how can we create assignments in the curriculum they're in, which is not cross-disciplinary in any way, but how can we create experiences for students where we initiate an AI experience and we help them process versus produce. We help them go through a process with AI to educate themselves, build something in that discipline. So I feel pretty good about where it is, at least in terms of that, because they didn't accept online learning 10 years ago. They didn't accept math programs that actually did the work for the students and then the grading for the teachers. So all of that, no. And then they're finally saying, yes, AI, yes, they're... But I don't know if they're going to do the right thing with it or if they even know what that is. But
so I think in Death of Recess, there are some answers in our document. There was one school in Australia where the school basically was a room like this, maybe 10 times this size. And the teachers and the students sat together, and the biotech company was next door. And the kids actually worked on real challenges. You know, if we're not using AI to solve real problems, I think we're missing the boat.
Not just to make the new music.
And so when the students, you know, when the kids are, you know, are next door working on real problems, they're probably seeing how AI is really being deployed.
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, I'm kind of like Woz. Woz is kind of he thinks AI is kind of overblown. It's become the marketing, you know, slogan right now.
There's so much money going into it. Well,
yeah.
I think back to what I was saying earlier that the AI understands how to use computers. The good news is it's a tool for us to use to leverage computers like we've never been able to use them before. Like, it gives us a superpower, someone who's worked with computers since I was in high school, that I never had before because I went through a coding boot camp and I learned JavaScript, HTML, and CSS, but the time that it took me to produce something that I had in my mind, I wasn't producing much of it. But now with AI, I know just enough on those disciplines to really start creating these web apps that, again, AI understands how to use the computer better than I do. So I'm just using AI as sort of the tool to help me tap into the capability of that computer.
The amplifier, using it as an amplifier, not a replacement.
Yes.
To amplify my ability to learn, not
to articulate. I will say I journal a lot too, John, and I'm using AI more and more to help me clarify my little thoughts that I can't really get onto paper very well. But I'm basically now writing like one or two lines and then I'm feeding it to AI and then AI is writing the rest. And I'm reading, I'm like, okay, that makes sense to me. And like, it's some clarity that I don't have to like belabor it over for many days. Like I'm sort of wrestling with, you know, trying to understand something that happened, and AI is helping me come to a conclusion much quicker so I can move on to the next thing, which is just a different way of kind of working through all of these problems that happen.
As long as it doesn't replace the concrete with a numbing agent and we still have the same result that we're bored for a long time.
Or it all starts to sound the same, like, right. Yeah, because that's, it's coming from our original information.
My movie writer, my kiddo, has now gone on to, he's at Cal State LA in computer science, but he's like, yeah, we just use it. He's back to boredom. And I'm like, what a waste of those years of precious, pure creativity, genius. Like, just give me the script, I can get it produced for you. And he's like, it's mine, I'm not sharing it. And now he's right back to like, yeah, we do AI, it's whatever. And I'm like, what a shame.
So Dave Pogue was the one that did the interview with me, and this is what he sent me. Done by AI. Oh.
John Couch in the house got a story to tell. From the Appaloosa days, many did it well. 2.5 hours, he laid it all down. From the Apple Revolution to Education Town. Started up a dream in a Silicon Valley swirl. Pioneered the way for the digital world. Managing the lease so the memories glide. Honest in his words, no secrets to hide. Thank you, Mr. Couch, for the time that you gave, for the stories, for the truth.
I thought I was pretty creative in way of saying thank you.
Wow.
He probably just knocked it out of there.
Opening the door, schools in Appletech building the bridge, connecting minds from the valley to the ridge, from the past to the present. He shared his tale every moment, every trial, every rise.
It was pretty true, too.
2.5 hours just wasn't enough. But the passion and the honesty, man, this stuff's tough. Thank you, Mr. Couch, for the time that you gave, for the stories, for the truth, for the legends you made.
He probably just took the interview transcript, fed it into Sona
or
whatever that is, and it basically...
But, I think the key for me is, like, when we were in school, we had to balance our time. You know, how much time do I want to put on 4 pages of long division arithmetic before I go play basketball, you know? And because everything was extrinsic requirements. And nothing was really creative or exciting. We were bored, right? I have a son who dropped out of high school because he was bored. And then he graduated from Savannah School of Art and Design with honors and started his own company. And now, because he told me when he was little, he says, Dad, I think in 3D. Yeah. Well, the technology caught up with his way of thinking. And now he's an incredible architect. Because he can draw it, he can take a picture from the sky and annotate it, but he dropped out of school because he was bored. And he also turns out he had one eye muscle had developed and the other eye muscle hadn't, and I was able to determine that because I worked with the Meekers and Jocelyn Learning Company on Structure of Intellect, which was the original. Modalities burst, and now it's turned out to be 20-something. But at first it was just, semantic learner, a visual learner, an auditory learner. I still have cartoons from him in first grade where it's Hobbes sitting there looking at the clock. Next frame, clock, clock, bell goes off, yay. I mean, in first grade, I should have known by just looking at what he was doing in first grade that problems were coming, with the schools.
Wow.
But I just think that the kids are much more capable, much more creative. We've got to give them the runway. That's the other thing I didn't talk about. We've got to allow them to fail. Mm-hmm. Our education system doesn't allow failure. Mm-hmm. I mean, we failed. Steve used to say, Bill Hewlett taught me the second lesson. He said, more companies will fail from indigestion than starvation, trying to do too much. Okay, and I think our school's got a little bit of too much. And Steve took that and said, we take as much pride in the 8 things we don't do as the 2 things that we do do.
Yeah, no, I
Hopefully
think you're right.
Well, he failed. We failed. Remember the cube?
Yeah. Well, he failed at Next big time, although that was a pretty slick company for a while.
Steve tended to be out in front. And out
time.
In front of everything, yeah. And he would take things away from people. And says, what? You're taking my disc away?
Right.
Like I said, Emerson said, people can only see what they only perceive what they see. And in fact, I had a locomotive engine. So the locomotive engine came over to the United States from England in 1800. And you know how it was positioned in the newspaper? Carrying 3 stagecoaches, hauling 3 stagecoaches. And I have another piece of artwork that I used to challenge the teachers with, and that was, it was the Pony Express artwork, Pony Express waving to the guys that are laying the telegraph pole. And you have to say, are we the Pony Express, mm-hmm. or are we laying the future infrastructure, mm-hmm. you know, for communication, for education? And we don't teach this stuff.
Well, I remember when they started taking ports off of the Macs, I was so upset because you couldn't plug in the things that you used to be able to plug in. I'm like, what are they doing? And now I realize, well, everything's wireless. They were ahead of their...
One last story, okay?
All right, this is the last piece.
Because I think it exemplifies our education system. I moved from California to France in the middle of eighth grade. My first assignment was to write a story. So I wrote a story about a cowboy murder, and we were in the courtroom, and the guy that was on the stand was actually the murderer, and he got caught in a lie because he said, well, I saw him stab him because of the moon was bright, and then we pulled out the almanac and said, well, there was no moon that night, so he was a liar, and so I had the judge sentencing him without a new trial. What did I know in eighth grade, right? I got a D. The two girls that sat next to me took an Archie comic book and word for word took it out of the Archie comic book and got an A.
Yep, you were told not to
fail. You know, I was creative, but obviously I wasn't a lawyer, you know? Well, they were not creative, they just copied it and they got an A. All and right. I think we do that all too often. We just push them on.
Yeah, our standards. Well, thank you, John. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Tech Reads, sponsored by Softech. If you enjoy today's show, please subscribe and share it with your colleagues. If you have comments, questions, or want to suggest an author for a future episode, visit Softech at softec.org and click on the Tech Reads link.